This is The Sweeper, the global football podcast with the best worldwide news and stories from the beautiful game, with Lee Wingate and Paul Watson.
Coming up on this episode, we witness an historic weekend of Maltese football live. Confusion reigns as two clubs claim to have won the Republic Youth League in Egypt, and a team in the Russian Premier League is allegedly poisoned. Hello and welcome to another episode of The Sweeper, the world football podcast with myself, Lee Wingate, and my fellow host, Paul Watson. Paul, between us, we've seen a lot of football in a lot of places in 2024. Madeira, Prague, New York, Vienna, Wales, and San Marino. It's a pretty good haul, I think. And now we can add Malta to that list, because I've just spent a weekend witnessing arguably one of the most memorable weekends in Maltese football history.
Which is, again, starting with a very sweeper sentence there, but also quite a dramatic one. So I take it you weren't disappointed by the potential title decider, which you went to see.
I was delighted because it all was so fortunate. Like, this is a trip that was planned months ago, just as a holiday with some friends. And it just all fell into place so nicely that there were three massive things that could potentially happen on the weekend I was there. So first of all, this title decider between Hamrun Spartans and Floriana, the top two in the league. Then you had the promotion race from the second division and the added extra of Valletta FC, one of the most storied clubs in Malta, potentially getting relegated for the first time ever. So it all just sat up so nicely.
That's amazing. So this was all happening on the, is it the penultimate weekend of the season this was? So it wasn't the final day.
Yeah, exactly. So it was match day 25, I believe, in the season. And obviously, most of the headlines were revolving around the fact that there was this title decider, Hamrun Spartans against Floriana, first versus second, 1 point separating the two. And essentially, Hamrun Spartans knew that they could win the title there and then with a win, whereas Floriana had to either get a draw or, preferably in their case, a win to take it to the final day. But because I've never seen a team win a league before, that's not something I've ever been there for live, decided had to go in with the Hamrun Spartans fans and you know, see what that atmosphere was like, because it was technically an away game for them, but it took place at the Takaali National Stadium, Malta's biggest football stadium, because it's a bit like Andorra and Gibraltar in the sense that they don't all have a stadium each. The games will take place in just three stadiums across the island, and one of them is the National Stadium. So although it was an away game, essentially both teams had half the stadium each, and it really felt like an even encounter in terms of the support.
This might be a stupid question, but where are both teams from exactly? Is Hamrun a place? Is Floriana a place? And is the stadium that you're talking about, is that in Valletta? Because obviously that's the capital. So can you talk me through the geography a bit? Because I have no geography at all in Malta.
So you have Valletta, the capital, on the east coast. And then west of that, you have two neighbouring districts. So Hamrun versus Floriana is essentially the two districts next to each other to the west of Valletta. And then the Takaali National Stadium is actually more in the centre of Malta. But the island is so small that you can get there with a taxi within like 15, 20 minutes. So most of the games take place there, basically.
Right, right. And so this game taking place, like, what was the crowd like? Did it feel like the whole island had mobilised for this? Or was it like a passionate, is there a nasty side to it? Or what's the atmosphere like at a game like this?
Well, what's the opposite word for low key? It was high key, if you can say that. It was honestly like 17,000 is the capacity of the stadium, and there were 8,500 fans there. But that's quite a lot when you consider the population of the whole island is 500,000. And it felt really atmospheric, especially being with the Hamrun Spartans fans, because they knew their team could win the league. Yeah, it was a really nice sunny day. Everyone was in a really good mood. Tickets are really cheap as well. Only €8, the price to get into this potential title decider. So it was all just like perfect circumstances. And there was a TIFO at the start, by the way. And I thought of you because you were caught under the TIFO at the game in Prague. And I was caught under the TIFO. I was standing there with my beer and suddenly this thing goes whizzing past my head. There's the TIFO going overhead. So yeah, it was all really good. I was slightly concerned that I was going to get that really, really badly burnt because I completely forgot to take sun lotion and you were completely exposed sitting in the main stand. But then the game got underway and I was immediately sort of swept away by the energy of Hammer and Spartans because these two teams, both head and shoulders above the rest in Malta this season, but Floriana in particular, a really tight defensive record. So they'd only conceded 11 goals in their 24 previous games in the league, less than, you know, one goal every two games. And within 18 minutes, it was 2-0 to Hamrun. By half time, it was 4-0 to Hamrun. And by the end, 5-0 to Hamrun Spartans was Floriana's biggest defeat in 10 years of domestic football. So it was just one-way traffic. It was electric. I was so impressed.
It's amazing. And so were one of these teams the champions from last year? Like, was this Hamrun retaining or were they sort of the contenders?
Yeah, so Hamrun were going for their 10th title, having won their 9th one last year. But Floriana are the joint record champions in Malta with 26 titles. So a title for them would make them the most successful club in Maltese football history. So there was so much riding on it. But yeah, it was just one-way traffic. Hamrun had a player called Seth Pantsil, who used to play here in Austria. Used to play for Hartberg, which is the club I've mentioned a few times now, the one that's got all the sponsors, including the sperm picture on their shirt. So I've seen him play before, but he was in a league of his own in Malta. He scored 4 of the 5 goals. And all the fans who had gone into the game, obviously, with an atmosphere of tension with so much riding on it, were blown away and were singing "We Are the Champions" by the 30th minute. They were oleing the passes by half time. At some point in the second half, they were singing the name of Joseph Portelli. Do you remember that name?
I know the name, but I can't place it. Oh, he's not the... Was there a president who wanted to play? Was that for Hamrun Spartans?
Yeah. In our very first episode we made together, so the 1st of February 2023, for any listeners that want to go back and listen to that. But Joseph Portelli, he's a construction tycoon in Malta, and he made headlines at least within sweeper circles last year, because he resigned as the club president of Hamrun Spartans in the hope that he could play for the club once the title had been wrapped up. But then the Maltese FA called an extraordinary meeting and rejected the request because they felt that it would bring the game in Malta into disrepute. So he was never able to play. But I went to the stadium thinking, I wonder how he's regarded in Maltese football. And I think the answer is very much, not so well by the rest of Maltese football, but my God, he's so popular with the Hamrun fans. So I think the first chant they started singing was Joseph Portelli to the tune of I Love You Baby by Frank Sinatra, which...
Brilliant.
Yeah, sort of gives you some indication about the high regard in which he's held. But then as soon as the final whistle was approaching, they started passing around an extra banner. It was like a Mexican wave banner. So the banner was just passed across the crowd, basically, with just Joseph Portelli's name on it. So, yeah, I think despite his sort of bizarre request to play, he's extremely popular here. And he seems to have really turned Hamrun's fortunes around because at the time he became the club president in, I think, 2021, I think it was something like close to 3 decades they hadn't won the league for. And now they've become champions in 3 of the last 4 seasons. And I think a lot of that is down to the investment they've had from him.
Wow. Yeah, that's a pretty impressive turnaround, isn't it? And for this year, obviously they are champions now, but that wasn't presented after the match or anything. But was there like a pitch invasion or like how did it end? Did the players do like sort of guards of honour and stuff? Or are they all waiting for this final game, which I guess must be pretty much, you know, next week must be just a party really for them?
Yeah, I mean, they all came over to the fans. There was a lot of really nice interaction, a lot of singing and chants, and all of the Hamrun fans stayed behind to sort of take that in, whereas the Floriana stand was deserted by, I think, sort of the midway point of the second half. Just a really nice occasion, though. And it really exceeded my expectations in terms of atmosphere. just being, you know, being technically a micro state in Europe, I didn't really expect the level of noise, the level of passion, really friendly fans as well. Nice balance between men and women, because you go into a lot of football stadiums and it is mostly men. But this was the highest proportion of women I've ever seen in a football stadium as well. So there are a few things there that sort of took me by pleasant surprise. Yeah, really enjoyed it. I actually don't know whether the trophy was presented that day, because having persuaded my friends to go to this title decider, I felt it might be a bit harsh to make them sit around and watch the trophy presentation. So we left and went back to the area where we were staying, which is the town of St. Julian's on the east coast. Went back to the hotel, got ready to go out for dinner. And as we came out of the hotel for dinner, I saw a bus going down the road, all red shirts, a trophy hanging out of the bus, lots of chanting, banners, and some fireworks being set off. I thought, that's got to be the Hammer and Spartans bus. What is the chance that they're doing a parade around the island and they're just in the town that I'm in, just at the right time? So producer Tom and I ran down the road to try and catch up with this bus. It stopped, the players all got out. We were taking photos thinking, amazing, we've managed to catch the Hammer and Spartans title parade. Only as we got really close up to it did we notice it wasn't Hammer and Spartans. It was another club playing in red based in the town of St. Julian's. It was Melita FC, and they had just secured promotion back to the Maltese top flight. So we ran down the road and accidentally got caught up in the second division champions open top bus parade.
That's amazing. There's not many countries on earth where that could happen. That's absolutely fantastic. So they'd just been promoted from the tier below that then and gone up. And as I understood it then, Valletta were fighting for their right to stay in that top division rank. Because Valletta, growing up, they were the team that if you said name a Maltese club, you'd say Valletta. You know, it was a bit of a gimme being the capital. But yeah, they've had hard times, right? So did you follow their fortunes sort of on that day, or was their game played on a different day from the derby?
So their game was played on the next day, on Sunday. And as it turns out, Melita will be replacing Valletta in the top flight. So Valletta, as you say, quite well known if you know Maltese football, the third most successful team in the country, 25 titles. And the day after the Hammer and game, they were relegated for the first time in their history. So it was really a big thing. I was actually in Valletta walking around the streets of the capital at the time this game was taking place. But again, this game was taking place over at the Takali National Stadium. And being based in the town, you would have had no idea that such a moment of sporting importance was taking place involving the city at that time. There was the game, you know, it wasn't on in bars. I didn't see people walking around in shirts. Basically saw no sign of it. And I don't know if that's because the fans are pretty disillusioned with what's been happening, or if, as I suspect, they were basically over at the stadium instead.
That's interesting. I mean, I remember going to Valletta, and it feels like it's got kind of a touristic, old towny kind of centre. And you kind of get the impression that life goes on there in that way year round, partly because I guess all the locals who are interested in football, as you say, are probably well out of there and at the stadium. But it's a weird thought, you just walking around Valletta on such a historic day and there not being any tears being shed. It's kind of how I imagined it. People weeping on the streets of Valletta. Did not seem to happen.
One thing that's worth pointing out about Valletta is that they have this bizarre tradition. So historically, having been very successful, they hold a funeral parade every time they win the league title. So basically what they do is when they win the league, they carry 13 coffins bearing the names of the other clubs in the division through the streets. Ooh. And so I think having done that, that's not exactly won them very many friends over the years. So now they've finally gone down, I think the rest of Malta will probably be laughing.
That's the weirdest tradition I've ever heard. Why take a moment of absolute jubilation and make it a sort of up yours to every other club in the league? That is a very, very strange tradition. As you say, I imagine they're not the neutral's choice then on the island in general.
No, I don't think so. Although I do think people recognise the importance of their loss and the impact that will have, because whenever one of the biggest clubs goes down, I think their absence is somehow a loss. And it also means as well, for the geography lovers out there, that they will be the only country in UEFA next season without a club from the capital, which is something really rare, because usually you always have a capital club in the league, but Malta won't next season.
That's quite a stat, isn't it? And I'm thinking, because of the geography, it's not as huge a loss in terms of, like, they're not being a club from Valletta, but they're probably clubs from very close by, aren't they? Some of these other clubs, you know, they're a matter of kilometres away, but it's still a great statistic. And it's definitely one that will win a pub quiz, that one. It's almost weirder the smaller the place is, in a way, isn't it? If you think about the really smallest states in Europe, it seems almost stranger not to have a capital club in there. So yeah, it's quite a fact.
Yeah, also, considering it's so small, so it's only 316 kilometres squared, the whole island. And the current makeup of the division is 14 clubs from 14 different villages, towns and cities. So there's not anywhere on the island, there's not one place that's got two clubs. And that sort of surprised me a little bit, considering its size.
Yeah, that is interesting. How does Gozo fit into this? Because as a geography lover, it was fascinating me that Gozo is part of Malta in football terms, and that you have this other island. But are there currently any teams from Gozo in that top flight, or are there going to be, or could there be even?
For people that aren't familiar with the geography of the Maltese islands, you have Malta, the main island, and then above that, as you say, you have Gozo, and in between them, you have a smaller island called Camino. And I saw both of those islands because on Friday, we took a boat trip, basically, all the way up past the east coast of Malta, and then went to a beautiful place called the Blue Lagoon for a spot of swimming. But that's basically next to Camino. Now, Camino, football-wise, doesn't have any football teams. Do you want to know why that is?
Is it not big enough? Does it not big enough to have a pitch or something like that?
It's not big enough to have a team pool. It's got two permanent inhabitants.
That's pushing it even for me, isn't it? That's not even a Paul Watson job, that one.
Need a few more players, I think. The island's sporting highlight, in 1959, it was selected as one of the host venues for the World Underwater Spearfishing Championships. But beyond that, not much sport to talk of.
Fair enough. So Gozo has probably a better chance of getting a team into that top flight.
Yeah, well, Gozo has 14 teams, but it's a completely separate pyramid, actually. So the Maltese League is basically only for clubs on the island of Malta, whereas Gozo's pyramid is for clubs only on the island of Gozo. So it has a top tier with 8 teams and a second division with 6 teams. And the only way they really mix is in the Maltese FA Trophy, which is like their FA Cup. And that's when the Gozo clubs come into it. But there's such a disparity between the clubs on Gozo and Malta that this season, for example, you only had 2 clubs from Gozo get to the last 32 of the Maltese FA Trophy. So it's not like they pull up any trees.
That's really interesting. So there is technically no route for a team from Gozo into Europe, as it were. You know, we've talked about Vaduz and their like massively complicated route from Liechtenstein playing in the Swiss pyramid. There's a very difficult route for them into European football. So team from Gozo has literally no route, or could they theoretically win Malta's FA Trophy and get in through that?
I suspect the latter, yeah. I suspect they could via the Maltese FA Trophy. But certainly I think none of the clubs from Gozo have ever won it. So I think the chances of that ever happening would be relatively slim. But all in all, it was a great weekend. Obviously, I can't promise the listeners that level of drama if they're to book a football weekend to Malta, but it was certainly hugely enjoyable. I would really recommend it.
That sounds like an amazing place to go and watch some football. The thing that, as you say, I was not sure about was what kind of atmosphere you'd get. You know, we've been to various micro states and, you know, small nations, and sometimes that passion for football just doesn't translate. You've been to Gibraltar too, haven't you? You'd say it's a lot more of a fervent atmosphere than you saw it in Gibraltar, I'd imagine.
Yeah, I think in Gibraltar, the tickets are free in a bid to get people to come to the stadiums, but the atmosphere isn't quite there. I mean, I was there for the cup final, so it was a little bit more atmospheric. But generally, yeah, I think Malta has to come top of our sort of internal microstate crowd rankings on the sweeper. Very impressed. I will try and do a little thread about Maltese football on Twitter as well, so you'll be able to see that in the coming days over at SweeperPod on our Twitter account. But we'll leave the Malta section there for now. Before we take a quick break, a quick favour to ask. Many listeners of our podcast regularly tune into the show, but don't yet follow us on Apple, Spotify, or other podcast platforms. So if you're enjoying our audio content on a regular basis, but don't yet follow us, please do so and hit that follow button on your pod platform. The more followers a show has, the more that improves the standing and the better it performs within the platform. So it's a quick, free and easy way to support us and help us grow. Time now for a quick bit of music, and then we'll be back in a second to tell you some fascinating football stories from around the world. Welcome back to part two of this episode of The Sweeper, where we have stories from the season run-ins in countries on three different continents: Africa, Europe, and South America. Paul, where do you want to kick it off?
I think Egypt. I think Egypt has appealed to my sense of chaos. So I think starting with this story of Egypt's youth championships and the Republic Youth League, I think would be the way that I would kick it off.
So tell us all about the chaos, because this is an absolutely fascinating story.
So first I became aware of it was there was a video doing the rounds of the final moments of this game between Al Ahly and NP. So they were competing for the Youth Championship League title. They were playing this match that would basically decide who won the title. And as the final whistle goes, both teams begin to celebrate, believing that they had won. Not believing they'd won the game, that had been won 4-3 by NP. There's no doubt about that. But both teams believe that scoreline would give them the title, and it made for exactly the kind of chaos that you'd imagine.
Yeah, so basically as the final whistle goes, you see both sets of players sort of wheeling away to the crowd, setting off flares, taking off their shirts and celebrating, but you don't really see at any point one of them looking over to the other and thinking, why are they celebrating? They just both seem to be getting on with it.
Yeah, and this in turn sent me down this kind of rabbit hole that I found very very hard to kind of get any information out of. Because it's a youth game, I presume, and because my Arabic is non-existent, I found it very hard to get to the bottom of why both sides would have believed they'd won. The closest I could get to was that there was a post from Al Ahly's youth side on Twitter that said, yep, we are definitely the champions. It's been confirmed by the league. We've won on goal difference. I don't know if it even said rather than a head-to-head comparison. So I assumed then that the MP were believing that in a tiebreaker situation, it was head-to-head record, whereas Al Ahly believed it was goal difference. But I'm not 100% sure that is actually the case.
Well, we did get a little bit of useful input from Mohamed El Sayed, an Egyptian football journalist. He was basically saying that the reason for the confusion is that MP have a pending appeal related to a game against Al Masry, and so they could win the title if that appeal is successful. Now, that doesn't really explain why they would have been celebrating on the pitch, because you can't really take it for granted that you're going to win an appeal. But essentially, what happened in this game against Al Masry is that they had an overage player, because as we said before, this is the Republic Youth League, players in the 2005 year group, so essentially an under-19 competition. And apparently, they had an overage player. So they must be pretty sure that they're going to win this appeal. But that seems to be another factor that's coming into this situation.
That would make a lot of sense, because from what I could see amongst comments that were going backwards and forwards, there was a lot of anger, understandably, from fans of both teams. But one thing that was being thrown around was fans saying, well, Al Ahly have got the federation in their pocket, so they will win the title. So that would make sense. It's people saying effectively, well, this appeal won't be successful then, because the powers that be want Al Ahly to win, because they are a very dominant force in Egyptian football. And so that makes a lot of sense now as to why both teams felt this was the result that would see them succeed. I mean, also, MP had won the game. So I guess for them, there was a sense they would celebrate winning that match. It was kind of almost stranger to see Al Ahly celebrate. But they've also got every right to think they'll win the title. So a really bizarre situation.
Yeah, it's not one I can say I've seen much of before. I don't know about you, but two teams both celebrating at the same time is a rare one.
Yeah, I've been on the receiving end of this.
Of course you have.
Yeah, well, this happened to me in Mongolia. So when I had a club that I was sort of co-owning there called Bayangul, we were in a playoff in the second division for promotion to the Premier League. And we're in this situation a bit like in Malta, as you've described. There's only one stadium that, you know, almost everyone plays at the same stadium. So we had a two-legged playoff final that was played with both legs being played in the same stadium. The first leg was 1-1. And as it got towards the end of the second leg, that was at 2-2, you know, 90th minute, the game's 2-2. Nobody was 100% sure which team was the home team and which team was the away team in each leg. And so as the final whistle went, again, both teams started to celebrate because both teams thought they'd won on away goals. And it was only when officials sort of hurriedly sort of started to come out of the stands with like, you know, books saying, well, actually, technically, you were home here. And it turned out we'd lost on away goals. But it was, again, as I described, I think, to people at the time, I was like, it was like the end of a boxing, you know, when there's a boxing match and it's going to go to a decision. And both boxers start celebrating because in a way they kind of want to tell the judges, yeah, I definitely won this. It was a bit like that, I think, because neither side knew which was the home leg, which was the away leg. So I think they thought if we celebrated enough, it would show the officials, yeah, this was definitely the right way around.
Do we want to move up from Al Ahly at youth level to Al Ahly at senior level? Because the senior team have achieved quite a unique feat at the moment, haven't they?
Yeah, they have. They've reached their fifth consecutive African Champions League final, which is a record, I believe. I don't think anyone's ever done that before. And it's actually a really interesting situation. We spoke about them a little bit earlier in the season when they played Zamalek, their bitter rivals. And one thing that's really fascinating is Al Ahly are 11th in the Egyptian Premier League at the moment. So when you sounds like they're having a sort of dreadful time of things, but actually it's because they've got six games in hand on pretty much everyone around them, largely because of these continental matches that they're playing. So you have this funny situation where they are the absolute dominant force in African football at the moment, but their league campaign has had to almost be put on hold while this takes place.
Yeah, I saw that they have up to 9 games in hand against some of the teams above them, which is just a truly bizarre situation. And they'll be playing in that final against Esperance de Tunis. It's a two-legged one on the 18th and 25th of May. You mentioned Zamalek there, their rivals. Zamalek have got to the final of the other African club competition, the CAF Confederations Cup, which we talked about on the last pod. And they got there by crushing Dreams, literally Dreams, Dreams FC of Ghana, to get to the final. And they will be playing against whom, Paul, in that final?
They'll be playing against RS Boukhana, who are from Morocco. Now, we spoke about them because the way that they got to the final was far from ideal. They've got there because of a forfeit, a defaulted game. Now, we discussed this before because in the first leg of the semi-final between Boukhana and Algiers, so Algiers from Algeria were hosting Boukhana. Boukhana's kits were confiscated at the airport because they contained a map of Morocco that had Western Sahara on it. This is like a very inflammatory thing politically in the region. Their kits were taken away and they refused to play the game until their kits were given back to them. The kits were not given back to them by kickoff time. So this was interesting because on the last pod, I actually think I surmised that it was possible the game would be given in favour of Algiers, the hosts, because Boukhana technically didn't turn up to the game. But actually, CAF took the side of Boukhana and said, look, we said these kits were fine. You've refused to let them have them. The game is actually defaulted in favour of Boukhana. And as a result, what happened was fairly inevitable. Algiers refused to play in that second leg in Morocco. And so again, defaulted the second leg as well, therefore handing the place in the final to the Moroccans. What was interesting is by all accounts, Algiers did turn up, which I'm not entirely sure why they did that, whether they were waiting to try and leverage some pressure on CAF to overturn that first decision by turning up, but they apparently were in the stadium and just did not come out for the match. And Boukhana just kicked the ball around, did a little training session, and have booked their place in the final. But it's yeah, whichever way you look at it, a very poor look for CAF and for such a major competition to be going into this kind of damp squib semi-final is a real shame.
Yeah, certainly is, isn't it? Continental semi-final is not something that you want to have highlighted for these kind of reasons. So yeah, interesting to see how that plays out and if it will be a year of Egyptian dominance, you know, across the board. If both Al Ahly and Zamalek win those finals, it will be a good year for Egypt. Now, let's move on to our next story now. And everything that we're about to say after this point is an allegation from the New Voice of Ukraine. So not something we are alleging, but something the New Voice of Ukraine is alleging about a game that took place in the Russian Premier League between the two southernmost clubs in the competition last week, Chechenian club Akhmat Grozny and Sochi from the Black Sea region. This game, a relegation six-pointer prior to kickoff, Sochi were bottom on 19 points, Grozny just in the drop zone by virtue of their goal difference. And what is alleged to have happened before this game is that the Sochi players were poisoned by men in the employ of Chechen warlord Ramzan Kadyrov. If you're not familiar with Ramzan Kadyrov, he is a highly controversial political figure, to say the least. He has been accused, among other things, of restricting the public lives of women, anti-gay purges, and involvement in kidnap, assassinations, and torture. He also has a very close association with Akhmat Grozny. And the allegation is that with Grozny in serious danger of going down from the Russian Premier League for the first time since 2008, the Sochi players were poisoned. And so 14 players, five staff members, all experienced severe illness, including nausea and diarrhea, just before kickoff. But they were still required to play the match. And they only lost it 1-0 in the end, which is not bad when you consider the circumstances.
That's an incredible effort, isn't it? I was going to ask, you know, did it work? If anyone who has anyone who's had food poisoning and had to do anything athletic will know it's absolutely misery. It's a misery unlike any other. So that's a very impressive achievement. I'm imagining there's no way to prove this, is there? This kind of allegation in terms of like what happens next for both clubs and what the league does about this. That there's probably not going to be an easy way to prove that this took place. So is it just bad luck for Sochi?
It's almost impossible to prove. I think when you look at other cases of food poisoning in football, we've had some in the Premier League as well in various different countries. How do you prove it? But by the same token, if the entire squad goes down with something, then it certainly does raise suspicions. Yeah, so that basically means that Akhmat Grozny are probably going to survive now and keep their place in the division, while Sochi look almost dead certs for relegation. So that's definitely something that's badly affected them. And I think it is worth looking at the sort of links between Akhmat Grozny and this Chechen ruler, Ramzan Kadyrov, because the club were actually formerly known as Terek, but they were renamed after Kadyrov's father, Akhmat, who was actually assassinated in a bomb explosion at the football stadium in 2004. So they were renamed. They have really close ties to him now. He's their honorary president. And basically, because of these connections, allegations of blackmail, sabotage and match fixing have followed Akhmat Grozny wherever they go. And some of the stories really are quite interesting. So in 2016, during a match between Akhmat Grozny and Rubin Kazan, the Akhmat Grozny chairman, Magomed Davudov, allegedly entered the referee's changing room at halftime to put pressure into them, ensuring that Grozny won the match. And the second half saw two Rubin Kazan players sent off, and Grozny came back to win 3-1.
Oh, wow. It's quite a lot of circumstantial evidence, isn't it? Yeah.
And then, a couple of years later, he seized control of the PA system at the Akhmat Arena on two occasions. One to call the referee a jerk and accuse him of being bought off by the opposition. And the second to call a referee a goat, which I presume is offensive.
Not the greatest of all time. I mean, yeah, I don't think you can do that. Usually. You see, I remember when, you might recall this, Ruud Gullit was brought in to manage what were then Terek Grozny. This had stuck in my head a little bit. And I think he only lasted a very short amount of time. And I remember at the time people saying, ethically, should he be doing this? But also, is he going to be safe? You know, if he doesn't deliver, is it like... And that really drew my attention at the time to the fact that this is not a club where you want to fail. This is also, sounds like, not a club where you want to mess around with like refereeing or any, you know, it'd be a horrible atmosphere to referee in that, I imagine.
Yeah, if I'm not mistaken, Ruud Gullit didn't last very long.
About 6 months. Yeah, 5 or 6 months. And I think, to be honest, that's probably the best case for him. I imagine he got paid off pretty handsomely and went on his way.
And moving on to our last story of the day, a bit of a funnier one. In Brazil, in the Ceará State Championship, the second level. So this is moving very much into sweeper territory, quite obscure this one. But a club by the name of FC Cariri beat Icasa 2-1 in the semi-finals of the state championship to qualify for the final and also secure promotion, because the two teams that reach this particular final are guaranteed promotion to Serie A of the Campeonato Cearense next season. So this was a big moment for them, which they celebrated in one of the most bizarre ways possible. All of the players lay down on the pitch and pretended to be dead in a bizarre tribute to the club's owner, who runs a funeral home.
I don't know what to even say to that. What a strange way to thank him. I mean, I guess we're lucky he doesn't own an adult entertainment channel.
Yeah, very good point. But you see the crowd sort of celebrating and looking down onto the players, and they're all just lying down on the pitch. It's very strange.
Do the fans know what's going on at the time? I wonder if the fans were just trying to work out what had happened, if that like, was everyone okay? Because it's not that obvious, is it, unless you said it, why they would be doing that?
Yeah. Well, the next game, anyway, they lost 3-0 in the final. So
Did they did that from the kickoff, did they?
Weirdly, the team that they lost to in the final, 3-0, was called Tirol, which is one of the 9 federal states in Austria. So quite why you've got a team named after an Austrian state playing in a Brazilian state championship, I don't know. That confused me a lot.
It's not possible, is it, that there's a community of Austrians that have set up a club? Especially in South America, sometimes there are clubs that come up with these names. You think that just sits completely at odds with the country. And then actually you scratch the surface, it turns out there is actually a large population of people who have come over from somewhere you just never expect and have set up a club. So who knows, it could be.
Anything else you want to tell us about today, or do we round off the episode there?
I think that's probably the main thing we wanted to round up.
We also have a very wide-ranging bonus segment that is out now for you to listen to as well on our Patreon page. What are we going to be talking about on that bonus podcast, Paul?
Well, we have pitches being consecrated in Latvia, footballs flying through people's windows in France, a guy in Switzerland who is racking up the goals because he used to be a professional player, and the big challenge from fans in Sweden to reject VAR.
Yeah, that's right. So all of that coming up on our Patreon segment. You can listen to that at patreon.com/sweeperpod and help support the pod as well. So do sign up to that at patreon.com/sweeperpod. Otherwise, we'll see you for our next episode on Wednesday, the 8th of May.